him on the members' letter board. One of the housing and local government team had lost his seat in the general election, and Charles had been promoted to number two on the opposition bench.
No more preservation of trees. You'll be on to higher things now, chuckled the chief whip. Pollution, water shortage, and exhaust fumes.
Charles smiled with pleasure as he walked through the commons, acknowledging old colleagues and noticing a considerable number of new faces. He didn't stop and talk to any of the newcomers, as he could not be certain if they were Labour or Conservative, and given the election result, most of them had to be Socialist. A doorkeeper in white tie and black tail jacket handed him a message to say that a constituent was waiting to see him in the central lobby. He hurried off to find out what the problem was, passing some of his older colleagues who wore forlorn looks on their faces. For some, it would be a considerable time before they were offered the chance of office again, while others knew they had served as ministers for the last time. As Macmillan had proclaimed, even the most glittering political career always ends in tears. But at 35, Charles dismissed such thoughts as he marched towards the waiting constituent. He turned out to be a red-faced master of hounds who had travelled up to London to grumble about the proposed private members' bill banning hair coursing. Charles listened to a 15-minute monologue before assuring his constituent that any such bill was doomed through lack of parliamentary time. The master of hounds went away happy, and Charles returned to his room to check over the constituency mail. Fiona had reminded him of the 800 letters of thanks to the party workers that had been franked but still needed topping and tailing after every election. He groaned.
Mrs. Blenkinsop, the chairman of Sussex Ladies Luncheon Club, wants you to be their guest speaker this year, his secretary told him once he'd settled.
Reply yes. What's the date?
Asked Charles, reaching for his diary.
16th of June.
Stupid woman. That's Ladies' Day at Ascot. Tell her that I'm delivering a speech at a housing conference, but I'll be certain to make myself free for the function next year.
The secretary looked up anxiously.
Don't fuss. She'll never know any better.
She moved on to the next letter.
Mr. Heath wonders if you can join him for a drink on Thursday, 6 o'clock.
Simon Karslake also knew it was going to be a long slog. He was aware the Tories would not change their leader until Heath had been given a second chance at the polls, and that could take every day of 5 years with a government which had a 97 majority. He began writing articles for the Spectator and for the Sunday Express Centre Pages, in the hope of building a reputation outside the House, while at the same time supplementing his parliamentary salary of £3,400. Even with Elizabeth's income as a consultant, he was finding it difficult to make ends meet, and soon their two young sons would have reached prep school age. He envied the Charles Seymours of this world, who did not have to give a second thought about their next paycheck. Simon wondered if the damn man had any problems at all. He ran a finger down his own bank account. As usual, there was a figure around £500 in the right-hand margin, and as usual, it was in red. Many of his Oxford contemporaries had already established themselves in the city or at the bar, and on a Friday evening could be seen being driven to large houses in the country. Simon laughed whenever he read that people went into politics to make money. He pressed on with demanding questions to the Prime Minister and tried not to show how frustrated he was by the expectations of his colleagues whenever he rose each Tuesday and Thursday. Even after it became routine, he prepared himself thoroughly, and on one occasion he even elicited praise from his normally taciturn leader. But as the weeks passed, he found that his thoughts continually returned to money, or to his lack of it. That was before he met Ronnie Nethercott. Andrew Fraser had often read that the anger or jealousy of one man could block the advance of a political career, but he still found it hard to accept that it could apply to him. What annoyed him even more was that Hugh Mackenzie's tentacles seemed to have spread through every other department.
Andrew's marriage to Louise Forsyth had been expansively covered in the national papers, and the absence of the Secretary of State at the wedding did not escape the notice of the Daily Express's William Hickey. They even published an out-of-date photograph of Alison Mackenzie looking sorrowful. Sir Duncan reminded his son that politics was for long-distance runners, not sprinters, and that he still had a few more laps to complete yet. An unfortunate analogy, considered Andrew, as he'd been a member of the Edinburgh University 4x110 relay team. Nevertheless, he prepared himself for the marathon.
Don't forget, Harold Macmillan spent 14 years on the back benches before holding office, Sir Duncan added.
Louise accompanied Andrew all over the country for his speeches of major importance, usually to an audience of less than 20. She only stopped travelling to Scotland every week when she discovered she was pregnant. To Louise's surprise, Andrew turned out to be a keen anticipatory father, determined his son would not think of him only as a politician. Single-handed, he converted one of the upstairs bedrooms in Cheney Walk into a nursery and sought her approval for a variety of blue decorative schemes. Louise was anxious that Andrew should extend the same feelings to their unborn child if they had a daughter.
This ends side one of cassette two. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
Raymond Gould quickly gained a reputation at the Department of Employment. He was thought of as extremely bright, demanding, hard-working, and not that it was ever reported to him, arrogant. His ability to cut a junior civil servant off in mid-sentence, or to correct his principal private secretary on matters of detail, did not endear him even to his closest staff, who always want to be loyal to their master. Raymond's workload was prodigious, and even the permanent secretary experienced Gould's unrelenting, "Don't make excuses," when he tried to trim one of the minister's private schemes. Soon, senior civil servants were talking of when, not whether, he would be promoted. His Secretary of State, like all men who were expected to be in six places at once, often asked Raymond to stand in for him. But even Raymond was surprised when he was invited to represent the department as guest of honour at the annual Confederation of British Industry dinner. Joyce checked to see that her husband's dinner jacket was well brushed, his shirt spotless, and his shoes shining like a guards officer's. His carefully worded speech, a combination of civil servant draftsmanship and a few more forceful phrases of his own, to prove to the assembled capitalists that not every member of the Labour Party was a raving commie, was safely lodged in his inside pocket. His driver ferried him from his Lansdowne Road home toward the West End. Raymond enjoyed the occasion, although he was nervous when he rose to represent the government in reply to the toast of the guests. By the time he had resumed his seat, he felt it had been one of his better efforts. The ovation that followed was certainly more than polite from what had to be classified as a naturally hostile audience.
"That speech was drier than the Chablis," one guest whispered in the chairman's ear,
but he had to agree that with men like Gould in high office, it was going to be a lot easier to live with the socialists. The man on Simon Karslake's left was far more blunt in voicing his opinion of Gould.
"Bloody man thinks he's a Tory. Talks like a Tory, so why isn't he a Tory?" he demanded.
Simon grinned at the prematurely balding man who had been expressing his equally vivid views throughout dinner. Corpulent and ruddy-faced, Ronnie Nethercott looked as if he was trying to escape from every part of his bulging dinner jacket. "I expect," said Simon in reply, "that Gould would have found it hard to join the Young Conservatives, born in the 30s and living in Leeds."
"Bowls," said Ronnie. "I managed it, and I was born in the East End of London, without any of his advantages. Now tell me, Mr. Karslake, what do you do when you're not wasting your time in the House of Commons?"
Raymond stayed on after dinner and chatted for some time to the captains of industry. A little after 11, he left to return to Lansdowne Road.
As his chauffeur drove slowly away from Grosvenor House down Park Lane, the Under-Secretary waved expansively back to his host. Someone else waved in reply. At first, Raymond only glanced across, assuming it was another dinner guest, until he saw her legs. Standing on the corner outside the petrol station on Park Lane stood a young girl, smiling at him invitingly. Her white leather miniskirt, so short it might have been better described as a handkerchief. Her long legs reminded him of Joyce 10 years before, except that they were black. Her finely curled hair and the set of her hips remained firmly implanted in Raymond's mind all the way home. When they reached Lansdowne Road, Raymond climbed out of the official car and said good night to his driver, before walking slowly towards his front door. But he did not take out his latchkey. He waited until he was sure the driver had turned the corner, before looking up and checking the bedroom window. All the lights were out. Joyce must be asleep. He crept down the path and back onto the pavement, then looked up and down the road, finally spotting the space where Joyce had parked the Sunbeam. He checked the spare key was on his keyring and fumbled about, feeling like a car thief. It took 3 attempts before the car spluttered into life, and Raymond wondered if he would wake up the whole road as he moved off and headed back to Park Lane, not certain what to expect. When he reached Marble Arch, he travelled slowly down in the centre stream of traffic. A few dinner guests in evening dress were still spilling out of Grosvenor House. He passed the petrol station. She hadn't moved. She smiled again, and he accelerated, nearly running into the car in front of him. Raymond travelled back up to Marble Arch, but instead of turning toward home, he drove down Park Lane again. This time, not as quickly, and on the inside lane. He took his foot off the accelerator as he approached the petrol station, and she waved again. He returned to Marble Arch before repeating his detour down Park Lane, this time even more slowly. As he passed Grosvenor House for a third time, he checked to be sure that there were no stragglers still chatting on the pavement. It was clear. He touched the brakes, and his car came to a stop just beyond the petrol station. He waited. The girl looked up and down the street before strolling over to the car, opening the passenger door, and taking a seat next to the Under-Secretary of State for Employment.
"Looking for business?"
"Well, what do you mean?" asked Raymond hoarsely.
"Come on, darling. You can't imagine I was standing out there hoping to get a suntan."
Raymond turned to look at the girl more carefully and wanted to touch her despite the aura of cheap perfume. Her black blouse had 3 buttons undone. A fourth would have left nothing to the imagination.
"It's £10 at my place."
"Where's your place?"
he heard himself say.
"I use a hotel in Paddington."
How do we get there?"
he asked, putting his hand nervously through his red hair.
"Just head up to Marble Arch, and I'll direct you."
Raymond pulled out and went off towards Hyde Park Corner, and drove round before travelling on up towards Marble Arch once again.
"I'm Mandy," she said. "What's your name?"
Raymond hesitated.
"Malcolm." "And what do you do, Malcolm, in these hard times?"
I sell second-hand cars."
"Haven't picked out a very good one for yourself, have you?"
she laughed. Raymond made no comment. It didn't stop Mandy.
"What's a second-hand car salesman doing dressed up like a toff, then?"
Raymond had quite forgotten he was still in evening dress.
"I've just been to a convention at the Hilton Hotel."
"Lucky for some," she said,
and lit a cigarette.
"I've been standing outside Grosvenor House all night in the hope of getting some rich fella from that posh party."
Raymond's cheeks nearly turned the colour of his hair.
"Slow down and take the second on the left."
He followed her instructions until they pulled up outside a small, dingy hotel.
I'll get out first, then you, she said. Just walk straight through reception and follow me up the stairs. As she got out of the car, he nearly drove off, and might have done so if his eye hadn't caught the sway of her hips as she walked back towards the hotel. He obeyed her instructions and climbed several flights of narrow stairs until he reached the top floor. As he approached the landing, a large, bosomy blonde passed him on the way down.
"Hi, Mandy,"
she shouted back at her friend.
"Hi, Sylve. Is the room free?"
"Just,"
said the blonde sourly. Mandy pushed open the door, and Raymond followed her in. The room was small and narrow. In one corner stood a tiny bed and a threadbare carpet. The faded yellow wallpaper was peeling in several places. There was a wash basin attached to the wall. A dripping tap had left a brown stain on the enamel. Mandy put her hand out and waited.
"Ah, yes, of course,"
said Raymond, taking out his wallet to find he only had £9 on him. She scowled.
"Not going to get overtime tonight, am I, darling?"
she said, tucking the money carefully away in the corner of her bag, before matter-of-factly taking off all her clothes. Although the act of undressing had been totally sexless, he was still amazed by the beauty of her body. Raymond felt somehow detached from the real world. He watched, eager to feel the texture of her skin, but made no move. She lay down on the bed.
"Let's get on with it, darling. I've got to live and to earn."
The minister undressed quickly, keeping his back to the bed. He folded his clothes in a neat pile on the floor, as there was no chair. Then he lay down on top of her. It was all over in a few minutes.
"Come quickly, don't you, darling?"
said Mandy, grinning. Raymond turned away from her and started washing himself as best he could in the little basin. He dressed hurriedly, realizing he must get out of the place as rapidly as possible.
"Can you drop me back at the petrol station?" Mandy asked.
"It's exactly the opposite direction for me," he said, trying not to sound anxious as he made a bolt for the door.
He passed Sylve on the stairs, accompanied by a man. She stared at him more closely the second time. Raymond was back in his car a few moments later. He drove home quickly, but not before unwinding the windows in an attempt to get rid of the smell of stale tobacco and cheap perfume. Back in Lansdowne Road, he had a long shower before creeping into bed next to Joyce. She stirred, only slightly.
Chapter 7 Charles drove his wife down to Ascot early to be sure to avoid the bumper-to-bumper traffic that always developed later in the day. With his height and bearing, Charles Seymour was made for tails and a topper, and Fiona wore a hat which on anyone else less self-assured would have looked ridiculous. They had been invited to join the Macfarlanes for the afternoon, and when they arrived, they found Sir Robert awaiting them in his private box.
"You must have left home early," said Charles.
"About 30 minutes ago,"
he said, laughing. Fiona looked politely incredulous.
"I always come here by helicopter,"
he explained. They lunched on lobster and strawberries, accompanied by a fine vintage champagne, which the waiter kept pouring and pouring. Charles might not have drunk quite as much had he not picked the winners of the first three races. He spent the fifth race slumped in a chair in the corner of the box, and only the noise of the crowd kept him from nodding off. If they hadn't waited for a farewell drink after the last race, Charles might have gotten away with it. He had forgotten that his host was returning by helicopter. The long tail of cars across Windsor Great Park, all the way back to the M4, made Charles very short-tempered. When he eventually reached the motorway, he put his Daimler into fourth gear. He didn't notice the police car until the siren sounded and he was directed to pull over.
"Do be sensible, Charles," whispered Fiona.
"Don't worry, old girl. I know exactly how to deal with the law," he said, and wound down the window to address the policeman who stood by the car. "Do you realize who I am, officer?"
No, sir, but I would like you to accompany me.
Certainly not, officer. I am a member of...
Do be quiet, said Fiona, and stop making such a fool of yourself.
Parliament. And I will not be treated...
Have you any idea how pompous you sound, Charles?
Perhaps you'll be kind enough to accompany me to the station, sir. I want to speak to my solicitor.
Of course, sir, as soon as we reach the station.
When Charles arrived at the constabulary, he proved quite incapable of walking in a straight line and refused to provide a blood sample.
I am the Conservative MP for Sussex Downs.
Which will not help you, Fiona thought. But he was past listening and only demanded that she phone the family solicitor at Speechley, Bertram and Soames. After Ian Kimmins had spoken first gently, then firmly to Charles, his client eventually cooperated with the police. Once Charles had completed his written statement, Fiona drove him home, praying that his stupidity would pass unnoticed by the press the following day. Andrew even bought a football, but hid it from Louise. As the months passed, Louise's slight frame expanded alarmingly. Andrew would rest his head on the bulge and listen for the heartbeat.
"It's a scrum half," he declared.
"Perhaps she's a centre forward," Louise suggested, "and will want to emulate the distaff side of the family."
"If he has to be a centre forward, he'll play for Hearts," Andrew assured her.
"Male chauvinist pig," she called to his back as he headed off to the Commons that morning. Andrew toyed with the names of Jamie, Robert, Hector, and Ian, and had settled on Robert before he'd reached Westminster. On arrival at New Palace Yard, he hailed the policeman on the gate and was surprised to see the familiar figure immediately rush toward him. Andrew wound down the window.
"What's the problem, officer?"
"Your wife's been taken to St. Mary's Paddington, sir. Emergency wing."
Andrew would have broken the speed limit all the way to Marble Arch if it hadn't been for the traffic. He kept praying he would be there in time, but he couldn't help remembering that Louise was only 6 months pregnant. When he arrived, the doctor on duty would not allow him to see her.
"How is Louise?" were Andrew's first words. The young doctor hesitated, then said,
"Your wife's fine, but I'm afraid she's lost the baby."
Andrew felt his whole body go limp.
"Thank God she's all right," he said.
"I'm afraid I can't let you see her until she's come out of sedation."
"Of course, doctor,"
said Andrew, glancing at the lapel badge on her white coat.
"But I can see no reason why you shouldn't have more children in the future,"
she added gently, before he had the chance to ask the question.
Andrew smiled with relief and began pacing up and down the corridor, unaware of the passing of time, until the doctor returned and said it would now be all right for him to see his wife.
"I hope you're not too disappointed,"
were Louise's first words when eventually he was allowed to see her.
"Don't be silly.
We'll have a dozen before we're through,"
he said, taking her hand. She tried to laugh.
"Do you know my doctor's husband?"
"Not that I'm aware of," said Andrew.
"Simon Carslake."
"Good heavens, yes. Very capable fellow.
Look aye, lass,"
said Andrew, putting on a deep brogue.
"You'll be a new woman after a couple of days' rest. I'll guarantee it."
"And if I'm not?"
"I'll stick with the old one.
And I tell you what, as soon as they let you out of this place, we'll go down to the south of France for the weekend."
"You don't like him because he comes from the East End," said Simon, after she had read the letter.
"That's not true," replied Elizabeth. "I don't like him because I don't trust him."
"But you've only met him twice."
"Once would have been enough."
"Well, I can tell you, I'm impressed by the not inconsiderable empire he's built up over the last 10 years. And frankly, it's an offer I can't refuse," said Simon, pocketing the letter.
I know we could do with a little more money, said Elizabeth, but surely not at any cost.
I won't be offered many chances like this, continued Simon. And frankly, we could use the money. The belief people have that every Tory MP has some lucrative sinecure and two or three non-executive directorships is plain baloney, and you know it. Not one other serious proposition has been put to me since I've been in the House, and another $2,000 a year for a monthly board meeting would come in very handy.
And what else?
And what do you mean, what else?
What else does Mr. Nethercott expect for his $2,000?
Don't be naive, Simon. He's not offering you that kind of money on a plate unless he's hoping to receive some scraps back.
Well, maybe I have a few contacts and a little influence with one or two people.
I'll bet.
You've just taken against him, Elizabeth.
I'm against anything that might in the long term harm your career, Simon.
Struggle on, but never sacrifice your integrity, as you're so fond of reminding the people of Coventry.
On Friday morning, 2 weeks later, Andrew and Louise set out for London Airport with one suitcase between them. As Andrew locked the front door, the phone rang.
No one's in, he shouted at the doorknob, but we'll be back on Monday.
He had booked a suite at the Colombe d'Or, nestled in the hills of Saint Paul in the south of France. He was determined to prise Louise away from London and see she had some sun and rest. The famous old hotel was everything the brochure had promised. On the walls hung paintings by Picasso, Monet, Manet, Utrio, all of which the patroness, Madame Rue, had accepted many years before in place of payment from artists who needed lodging and a square meal. On the way up the winding staircase, Louise was nearly knocked out by a Calder mobile, and a Courbet hung above the bed in their room. But it was the bed itself, a 16th-century four-poster, that they both coveted. They were soon to discover it possessed a mattress so comfortable that visitors always overslept. The food was memorable, and they walked through the green hills each day to be sure that they could tackle another full dinner at night. 3 days of no television, no radio, no papers, and no telephone ensured that by Monday morning they were ready to face London. They swore they would return again soon. Once their plane had landed at Heathrow, they were made aware that the holiday was over. 20 minutes passed before someone pushed the waiting steps up to the Vanguard's door. Then a crowded bus to the terminal that seemed miles away was followed by a route march to customs. Despite their first-class tickets, their bags were among the last off. By the time the taxi had crawled through the morning rush hour to their front door in Cheyne Walk, all Louise could say was, "I need another holiday." As Andrew put his latchkey in the door, the telephone started ringing.
"I hope they haven't been trying all weekend," Louise said.
Andrew put the phone to his ear as it went dead.
"Just missed, whoever it was," said Andrew, picking up several brown envelopes from the floor. "France already seems about a week ago."
He kissed his wife.
"Must get changed and be off to the house," he said, checking his watch.
"How has the nation managed to survive without you?" mocked Louise. When the phone rang again, Andrew was just stepping out of the bath.
"Can you take it, Louise?" he shouted.
A moment later, he heard her rushing up the stairs.
"Andrew, it's the Prime Minister's office."
He ran, dripping and naked, to the bedroom phone and picked up the extension.
"Andrew Fraser," he said.
"This is number 10, said an official-sounding voice. "The Prime Minister has been wanting to contact you since Friday morning."
"I'm sorry. I took my wife to Provence for the weekend."
"Really, sir?" said the voice, not sounding at all interested. "May I tell the Prime Minister you are now free to speak to him?"
"Of course," said Andrew, frowning at his nude reflection in the mirror. He must have put on half a stone. It would have to be 4 games of squash this week, and no more wine at lunch.
"Andrew!"
"Good morning, Prime Minister."
sad news about you, Mackenzie.
Yes, sir, said Andrew automatically.
They warned me about his heart before the last election, but he insisted he wanted to carry on. I've asked Bruce to be the new Secretary of State and Angus to take his place as Minister. They both want you to be the new Under-Secretary. How do you feel about it?
I'd be delighted, Prime Minister, Andrew stammered, trying to take in the news.
Good. And by the way, Andrew, when you open your first red box, you won't find any tickets for Glumdaw, so I do hope Louise is fully recovered.
The phone clicked. They had tracked him down, but the Prime Minister had left him in peace. The first official function Andrew Fraser attended as Her Majesty's Under-Secretary of State at the Scottish office was Hugh Mackenzie's funeral.
Think about it, Simon, said Ronnie
as they reached the boardroom door.
£2,000 a year may be helpful, but if you take shares in my property company, it will give you a chance to make some capital.
What do you have in mind? Asked Simon, doing up the middle button of his blazer and trying not to sound too excited.
Well, you've proved damn useful to me. Some of those people who you bring to lunch wouldn't have allowed me past their front doors. I'd let you buy in cheap. You could get hold of 50,000 shares at £1, so when we go public, you'll make a killing.
Raising £50,000 won't be that easy, Ronnie. When your bank manager has checked over my books, he'll be only too happy to lend you the money. You'll see. After the Midland Bank had studied the authorised accounts of Nethercott & Company, and the area manager had interviewed Simon, they agreed to his request on the condition that Simon lodged the shares with the bank. How wrong Elizabeth was proving to be, Simon thought. And when Nethercott & Company went on to double their profits for the year, he brought home a copy of the annual report for his wife to study. Looks good, she had to admit. But that still doesn't mean I have to trust Ronnie Nethercott. When Charles Seymour's drink-driving charge came up in front of the Reading bench, he listed himself as C.G. Seymour, no mention of MP. Under profession, he entered banker. He came sixth in the list that morning, and on behalf of his absent client, Ian Kimmings apologised to the Reading magistrates and assured them it would not happen again. Charles received a £50 fine and was banned from driving for 6 months. The whole case was over in 4 minutes. When Charles was told the news by telephone later that day, he was appreciative of Kimmins' sensible advice and felt he had escaped lightly. He couldn't help remembering how many column inches George Brown, the Labour Foreign Secretary, had endured after a similar incident outside the Hilton Hotel. Fiona kept her own counsel. At the time, Fleet Street was in the middle of the silly season, that period in the summer when the press are desperate for news. There had only been one cub reporter in the court when Charles's case came up, and even he was surprised by the interest the Nationals took in his little scoop. The pictures of Charles, taken so discreetly outside the Seymours' country home, were now glaring from the pages the following morning. Headlines ranged from 6 months ban for drink-drive son of Earl to MP's Ascot binge ends in heavy fine. Even the Times mentioned the case on its home news page. By lunchtime the same day, every Fleet Street newspaper had tried to contact Charles, and so had the chief whip. When he did track Charles down, his advice was short and to the point. A junior shadow minister can survive that sort of publicity once, not twice.
Whatever you do, don't drive a car during the next 6 months, and don't ever drink and drive again.
Charles concurred, and after a quiet weekend, hoped he'd heard the last of the case. And then he caught the headline on the front page of the Sussex Gazette. Member faces no confidence motion. Mrs. Blenkinsop, the chairman of the Ladies' Luncheon Club, was proposing the motion, not for the drunken driving, but for deliberately misleading her about why he had been unable to fulfil a speaking engagement at their annual luncheon. Raymond had become so used to receiving files marked strictly private, top secret, or even for your eyes only, in his position as a government undersecretary, that he didn't give a second thought to a letter marked confidential and personal, even though it was written in a scrawled hand. He opened it while Joyce was boiling his eggs.
4 minutes and 45 seconds, just the way you like them, she said as she returned from the kitchen and placed two eggs in front of him.
Are you all right, dear? You're white as a sheet. Raymond recovered quickly, pushing the letter into a pocket before checking his watch.
Haven't the time for the other egg, he said. I'm already late for cabinet committee. I must dash.
Strange, thought Joyce, as her husband hurried to the door. Cabinet committees didn't usually meet until 10, and he hadn't even cracked open his first egg. She sat down and slowly ate her husband's breakfast, wondering why he had left all his post behind. Once he was in the back of his official car, Raymond read the letter again. It didn't take long.
Dear Malcolm, I enjoyed our little get-together the other evening, and £500 would help me to forget it once and for all. Love, Mandy. P.S. I'll be in touch again soon.
He read the letter once more and tried to compose his thoughts. There was no address on the top of the notebook paper. Neither letter nor envelope gave any clue as to where they had come from. After he'd arrived outside the Department of Employment, Raymond remained in the back seat for several moments.
Are you feeling all right, sir? His driver asked.
Fine, thank you, he replied, and jumped out of the car and ran all the way up to his office. As he passed his secretary's desk, he barked at her, No interruptions.
You won't forget the cabinet committee at 10 o'clock, will you, Minister?
No,
replied Raymond sharply, and slammed his office door. Once at his desk, he tried to calm himself and recall what he would have done had he been approached by a client as a barrister at the bar. First, instruct a good solicitor. Raymond considered the two most capable lawyers in England to be Arnold Goodman and Sir Roger Pelham. Goodman was getting too high a profile for Raymond's liking, whereas Pelham was just as sound but virtually unknown to the general public. He called Pelham's office and made an appointment to see him that afternoon. Raymond hardly spoke in cabinet committee, but as most of his colleagues wanted to express their own views, nobody noticed. As soon as the meeting was over, Raymond hurried out and took a taxi to High Holborn. Sir Roger Pelham rose from behind his large Victorian desk to greet the junior minister.
I know you're busy, man, Gould, Pelham said as he fell back into his black leather chair. So I shan't waste your time. Tell me, what can I do for you?
It was kind of you to see me at such short notice, Raymond began, and without further word handed the letter over.
Thank you, the solicitor said courteously, and pushing his half-moon spectacles higher up on his nose, he read the note 3 times before he made any comment. Blackmail is something we all detest, he began. But it will be necessary for you to tell me the whole truth, and don't miss out any details. Please remember, I am on your side. You'll recall only too well from your days at the bar what a disadvantage one labours under when one is in possession of only half the facts.
The tips of Pelham's fingers touched, forming a small roof in front of his nose, as he listened intently to Raymond's account of what had happened that night.
"Could anyone else have seen you?" was Pelham's first question.
Raymond thought back and then nodded.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, I'm afraid there was another girl who passed me on the stairs."
Pelham read the letter once more.
"My immediate advice," he said, looking Raymond in the eye
and speaking slowly and deliberately.
"And you won't like it. Is to do nothing."
"But what do I say if she contacts the press?"
"She will probably get in touch with someone from Fleet Street anyway, even if you pay the £500, or however many other 500s you can afford.
Don't imagine you're the first minister to be blackmailed, Mr. Gould. Every homosexual in the House lives in daily fear of it. It's a game of hide-and-seek. Very few people other than saints have nothing to hide. And the problem with public life is that a lot of busybodies want to seek.
Raymond remained silent, trying not to show his anxiety.
"Phone me on my private line immediately after the next letter arrives," said Pelham, scribbling a number on a piece of paper.
"Thank you," said Raymond, at least relieved that his secret was now shared with someone else. Pelham rose from behind his desk and accompanied Raymond to the door.
"You'll be glad to see Yorkshire back as county champions," said the solicitor as he walked down the long passage with the minister.
Raymond did not reply. When they reached the outer door, they shook hands formally.
"I'll wait to hear from you," said Pelham.
Pity that the man showed no interest in cricket. Raymond left the solicitor's office feeling better, but he found it hard to concentrate on his work the rest of that day, and slept only in fits and starts during the night. When he read the morning papers, he was horrified to see how much space was given to Charles Seymour's peccadillo. What a field day they would be able to have with him. When the post came, he searched anxiously for the scrawled handwriting. It was hidden under an American Express circular. He tore it open. The same hand was this time demanding that the £500 should be deposited at a newsagent in Pimlico. Sir Roger Pelham saw the minister 1 hour later. Despite the renewed demand, the solicitor's advice remained the same. Andrew Fraser never stopped moving from one city to another because the Scottish office had to show a presence in Edinburgh and Glasgow as well as in London. Louise did not complain. She had never seen her husband so happy. The only moment of light relief during his first 3 months as a minister came when Andrew found it necessary to send a letter to his father, addressed "Dear Sir Duncan," which went on to explain why he had to reject his offered advice on a Highlands and Islands Board project. Andrew was particularly pleased with the line, "I have for some considerable time listened to both sides of the argument." Once he had settled in his favourite chair that night with a large whisky in his hand, Louise told him she was pregnant again.
"When did I find the time?" he asked, taking her in his arms.
"Maybe the half hour between your meeting with the Norwegian fishing minister and the address to the oil conference in Aberdeen."
When the AGM of the Sussex Downs Conservative Association came round in October, Charles was pleased to learn that Mrs. Blenkinsop's no-confidence motion had been withdrawn. The local press tried to build up the story, but the Nationals were full of the Aberfan coal tip disaster, in which 116 schoolchildren had lost their lives. No editor could find space for Sussex Downs. Charles delivered a thoughtful speech to his association, which was well received. During question time, he was relieved to find no embarrassing questions directed at him. When the Seymours finally said good night, Charles took the chairman to one side and inquired, "How did you manage it?"
"I explained to Mrs. Blenkinsop," replied the chairman, "that if a motion of no confidence was discussed at the AGM, it would be awfully hard for the member to back my recommendation that she should receive an OBE in the New Year's honours for service to the party. That shouldn't be too hard for you to pull off, should it, Charles?"
Every time the phone rang, Raymond assumed it would be the press asking him if he knew someone called Mandy. Often it was a journalist, but all that was needed was a quotable remark on the latest unemployment figures, or a statement of where the minister stood on devaluation of the pound. It was Mike Malloy, a reporter from the Daily Mirror, who was the first to ask Raymond what he had to say about a statement phoned into his office by a girl with a West Indian accent called Mandy Page.
"I have nothing to say on the subject. Please speak to my solicitor, Sir Roger Pelham,"
was the Undersecretary's succinct reply. The moment he put the phone down, he felt queasy. A few minutes later, when the phone rang again, Raymond still hadn't moved. He picked up the receiver, his hand still shaking. Pelham confirmed that Malloy had been in touch with him.
"I presume you made no comment," said Raymond.
"On the contrary," replied Pelham, "I told him the truth."
"What?"
exploded Raymond.
"Be thankful she hit on a fair journalist, because I expect he'll let this one go. Fleet Street are not quite the bunch of shits everyone imagines them to be,"
Pelham said uncharacteristically, and added,
"They also detest two things, bent policemen and blackmailers. I don't think you'll see anything in the press tomorrow."
Sir Roger Pelham was wrong. Raymond was standing outside his local newsagent the next morning when it opened at 5:30, and he surprised the proprietor by asking for a copy of the Daily Mirror. Raymond Gould was plastered all over page 5, saying, "Devaluation is not a course I can support while the unemployment figures remain so high." The photograph by the side of the article was unusually flattering. Simon Karslake read a more detailed account of what the minister had said on devaluation in The Times, and noted Raymond Gould's firm stand against what was beginning to look like inevitable government policy. Simon looked up from his paper and started to consider a ploy that might trap Gould. If he could make the minister commit himself again and again on devaluation in front of the whole House, he knew that when the inevitable happened, Gould would be left with no choice but to resign. Simon penciled a question on the top of the paper before returning to the political columns. The devaluation news had caused a Tory lead in the opinion polls of 8%, and despite a majority of 95 in the Commons, the government had actually lost a vote on the floor of the House the previous day. Nevertheless, Simon still could not envisage a general election for at least another 2 years. On the business front, Simon had advised Ronnie Nethercott not to allow his company shares to be traded on the stock exchange until the Tories returned to power. The climate, he assured Ronnie, should be much easier then. Charles Seymour was glad to be behind the wheel again after his driving ban had been completed, and he had the grace to smile when Fiona showed him the photograph of the happy Mrs. Blenkinsop displaying her OBE outside Buckingham Palace to a reporter from the Sussex Gazette. It was 6 months to the day of his first meeting with Sir Roger Pelham that Raymond Gould received an account from the solicitor for services rendered. £500. He sent the cheque by return of post in a parcel that also contained a copy of the recently published edition of Wisden.
This ends side two of cassette two of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 3. First Among Equals, cassette 3.
Chapter 8. Andrew had been warned by his ministerial colleagues that the first day answering questions at the dispatch box would be an experience he was unlikely to forget. Questions for the Scottish office appear on the order paper on a Wednesday once every 4 or 5 weeks, and each minister answers on behalf of his own department between 2:35 and 3:20. There are usually 4 or 5 ministers of the Crown, not including the law officer, available to represent each great department of state. During the 40-minute to 1-hour period, the ministers would expect to reply to about 25 questions. But it is rarely the questions that are the problem. It is the supplementaries. Any member can place a question through the table office to any minister and can word it in a seemingly innocuous way. When does the minister hope next to visit Aberdeen? To which the minister concerned may reply anything from next week to I have no plans to do so in the foreseeable future. But when the member who put down the question rises from his seat to ask his supplementary, he can change the subject completely.
Does the minister realize that Aberdeen has the highest rate of unemployment in the United Kingdom? And what new ideas does his department have to deal with this problem?
The hapless minister must then come up with a convincing reply on the spot.
In an attempt to see that a minister is adequately briefed, his department will spend the morning scrutinizing each tabled question and looking for pitfalls he might encounter. A variety of possible supplementaries will be placed in his brief with appropriate answers. Ministers can, of course, always ask colleagues on their own side what they're hoping to find out from their tabled questions. But opposition members use question time to test a minister in the hope of discovering some weakness in his armory, thus making the government appear incompetent. Andrew spent a considerable time in preparation for his first encounter at the dispatch box, although the more senior and experienced ministers in the Scottish office had agreed to handle any questions that looked hostile. He ended up having to respond to only one question from the opposition benches, while fielding four from his own. Added to which, the timing was such that question number 23 from the opposition member seemed unlikely to be reached by 3:20, when the Solicitor General for Scotland would have to start answering questions himself. Andrew's first four answers to questions numbers 5, 9, 11, and 14 went smoothly enough. He opened his dark blue file and was pleased to confirm the well-prepared briefs to everything that was thrown at him. By 3:15, when question number 19 was being answered, Andrew sat back on the front bench and began to relax for the first time that day. The Solicitor General for Scotland entered a now packed Commons, and moving alongside the table in the centre of the chamber, he crouched slightly to be sure he did not obscure the Speaker's view of the government benches on his right. The Prime Minister had been left a place between the Chancellor and the Foreign Secretary, and waited for the clock to reach 3:20. The Speaker called question number 21, but the member was not present. He called number 22, and once again the member was absent. Each had obviously considered that their question had little chance of being reached before 3:20. At 3:18, the Speaker called question 23. Andrew's heart sank, which read on the order paper, "Had the Minister been invited to visit the Kinross Nursing Home?" Andrew rose, opened his folder, and said, "No, sir." "No one in the House will be surprised by the Minister's reply," said George Younger, the member for Eyre, "because the nursing home has 49 occupants, 47 of whom have their own television sets, and yet the Minister demands 47 separate license fees. If they were to congregate in one room, he would expect only one fee. Is this another example of the Labour Party's Care for the Aged programme that we hear so much about nowadays?" Andrew rose to the dispatch box to cries of, "Answer! Answer!" from the opposition benches. He had checked his crib sheet while sitting on the edge of his seat. Andrew had a prepared answer for medical facilities, old age pensions, supplementary benefits, food allowances, medical charges, but nothing on TV licenses. As he stood stranded at the dispatch box, he was aware for the first time of the pitfalls that a minister encounters when he is not fully prepared. Such a system might appear wonderfully democratic to onlookers, he thought, until you're the Christian facing the 300 hungry lions. A handwritten note was quickly passed along the front bench to him from one of the civil servants who sit in the official box to the left behind the Speaker's chair. With no time to consider its implications, Andrew crossed his fingers and read the note out to the House. "This was a decision taken by the last administration, of which the Honourable Gentleman was a member. We have seen no reason to reverse that decision," he read, thinking how much like a parrot he sounded. He sat down to polite government murmurs and some considerable relief. Mr. Younger rose again and was allowed a second supplementary.
"Mr. Speaker, this is the sort of inaccuracy we've grown to expect from this government. The decision he refers to was made by his right honourable friend, the Secretary of State, only last year,
And I think the minister will find, if he does his research more fastidiously, that his party was in power at the time.
The opposition howled with delight. Andrew rose again and gripped the sides of the dispatch box to avoid anyone seeing that he was shaking in fear. Several members of the government front bench had their heads bowed. The opposition had drawn blood and were baying in triumph. Lord Attlee's words came back to Andrew. When you're caught out by the House, admit it, apologize, and sit down. Andrew waited for the noise to subside before he replied.
The Secretary of State warned me that a new minister will never forget his first question time, and I feel bound to agree with him.
Andrew, who knew how the atmosphere in the House can change in a moment, felt such a moment now, and before it could turn back, added,
On the question of television licenses in the Kinross nursing home, I apologize to the Honourable Gentleman for Eyre for my mistake, and I will look into the case immediately and send him a written reply within 24 hours.
Hear, hears could now be heard from his own benches, and the opposition benches were quietened. Mr. Younger was trying to interrupt again, but as Andrew didn't give way, he had to resume his seat, knowing the Speaker would not call on him again once the clock had passed 3:19. Andrew waited for silence before adding,
And I blame my grandmother for this, who, as president of the Kinross Nursing Home and a staunch Conservative, has always believed in increasing old-age pensions rather than looking for false subsidies that can never be fair to everyone.
By now the Labour members were laughing, and all the heads on the front bench were looking towards the new minister, who remained at the dispatch box until the House was silent again.
My grandmother would be delighted to learn that this administration has raised that old-age pension by 50% in the 3 years since we've taken office.
The Labour backbenchers were now cheering and waving their order papers as Andrew resumed his seat, while the opposition was silent and glum. The hands of the clock touched 3:20, and the Speaker said,
The Solicitor General's questions.
Andrew Fraser had made a political reputation, and as the laughter echoed round the House, the intense figure sitting on the end of the front bench put a hand through his red hair and wondered if he could ever match Andrew's skill at the dispatch box. On the opposition backbenches, Simon Carslake made a mental note to be cautious if he ever thought of putting a sharp question to Andrew Fraser. As soon as the Solicitor General's questions were over, Simon left the House and drove himself to Whitechapel Road. He arrived a few minutes after the 4 o'clock board meeting of Nethercott and Company had begun, quietly took his seat, and listened to Ronnie Nethercott describing another coup. Ronnie had signed a contract that morning to take over a major city block at a cost of £15 million, with a guaranteed rental income of over £1.1 million per annum for the first 7 years of a 21-year lease, with 7-year rent reviews. Simon formally congratulated him, and asked if this made any difference to the company's timing for going public.
"Why do you ask?" said Ronnie.
"Because I still feel it might be wise to wait until we know the result of the next general election. If the Conservatives return to power, as the opinion polls forecast, that could change the whole atmosphere for launching a new company."
"If they don't, I shan't hold up going public much longer."
"I wouldn't disagree with that decision either, Mr. Chairman," said Simon. When the meeting was over, he joined Nethercott in his office for a drink.
"I want to thank you," Ronnie said, "for that introduction to Harold Samuel and Lewis Friedman. Made the deal go through much more smoothly."
"Does that mean you'll allow me to purchase some more shares?" Ronnie hesitated.
"Why not? You've earned them. But only another 10,000. Don't get ahead of yourself, Simon, or the other directors may become jealous."
In the car on the way to pick up Elizabeth, Simon decided to take a second mortgage out on the house in Beaufort Street to raise the extra cash needed for the new shares. He thought it might be wise not to trouble her with the details. He savoured the prospect of the Conservatives winning the next election, perhaps being given office in the government,
and selling his shares for a sum that would make it possible for him to stop the